So today we're happy to have Melissa Diamond as our speaker. Melissa is a senior PhD student at Johns Hopkins, and she's gonna tell us about the merger of dark matter blobs. Please, Melissa, feel free to start.
All right, well, as Christina said, I'm Melissa Diamond. I'm a soon to be graduating grad student at Johns Hopkins, and excited to be here. So I'm going to talk to you today about mergers of binary blobs of dark matter and how this can let us observe parts of dark matter parameter space that are difficult to see otherwise. This is part of ongoing work with David Kaplan and Surjit Rajendran, which by ongoing, I mean the science is done and we're editing the writing now. So hopefully you'll be seeing it soon. Now, before I dive into the work I've done, I'm going to talk a bit about just dark matter and why I'm interested in using techniques to understand dark matter and understanding it has been a central goal of cosmology, astrophysics, and particle physics at this point for decades. Despite that, we don't know a ton about it. We know that it makes up about 26% of the mass energy in the universe, with ordinary matter, that Okay standard model, as far as we can tell, only composing 5% of that material. So 80% of the gravitating matter in the universe is dark. Now, when I say dark, I mean that it doesn't have strong electromagnetic interactions. It doesn't mean it has none, just that it doesn't interact strongly enough that we've been able to use those interactions to observe it yet. But importantly, we know that dark matter interacts with gravity and that it plays an essential role in shaping the universe into what we know and love today. It's, you know, providing the scaffolding that's holding galaxies and clusters of galaxies together. And it's provided the initial seeds that allowed these galaxies to form in the first place. So because dark matter is so important from a cosmological perspective, and we've been interested in it for so long, there's a wide range of different candidates and theories for what dark matter could be. This spans something like 80 orders of magnitude in mass. And generally, it's convenient to group different types of dark matter by their masses because theories with the same mass will often share different properties, and we may be able to use the same tools to observe them. Let me take you on a little tour of the landscape of dark matter candidates.
So, sorry to interrupt.
Starting with the...
Melissa, maybe it's better if you turn off your video because sometimes you break up.
Sure, yeah. All right, Thanks. Let's try again without video.
Thank you.
Yeah, so in the lightest range of dark matter parameter space, we've got ultralight dark matter. And this is a very popular candidate right now, where one of the sort of popular candidates within that are axions and axion-like particles. This is an interesting part of parameter space because these particles are so light, and there have to be so many of them, that in many cases, this dark matter will behave as an oscillating field as opposed to individual particles. And because there's a lot of recent interest, there are a variety of different efforts in place to observe this type of dark matter. So we've got different, what I'll call direct detectors, on Earth, but there's also searches for astrophysical effects. We can look for axions around black holes. We can look for evidence of them in the magnetic fields around neutron stars. And we can also look for them cosmologically, because axions are expected to cause polarized light from the cosmic microwave background to rotate as it transits toward the Earth. Moving up in mass is particle dark matter. And for a long time, WIMPs, the interacting massive particles, were the most popular dark matter candidate. Because this was something of interest for many years, there are, again, a lot of efforts that have been made to try to look for evidence of dark matter in this part of parameter space. Again, a variety of direct detectors, but also searches at colliders, such as the Large Hadron Collider, looking for maybe dark matter particles produced in those collision events. But we also can, again, rely on physical tools. Particle dark matter can interact with itself and produce gamma rays. It can interact in the sun and produce neutrinos. There are a lot of different tools, and because we've thought about this for a long time, there are just a lot of different attempts and searches to understand particle dark matter. Jumping up to the highest masses is primordial black holes and MACHOs. Primordial black holes are similar to astrophysical black holes, though they don't form from collapsing stars. These form very early in the universe. And MACHO just means massive compact halo objects. So in either case, these heavy objects have been recently, I'd say, quite well investigated and largely ruled out. A powerful tool in this mass range is gravitational lensing, where black hole, for example, could pass between the Earth and a distant bright source, and the mass of the black hole will bend the light around itself as it's coming to the Earth. So there are different searches for this effect. One can also rely on wide stellar binaries. Black holes will pass by and tend to destabilize those. Excess radiation from black holes accumulating dark matter, or gravitational waves from interacting with themselves. So another part of parameters with a lot of different handles. Now it's at this point that you might have noticed that there's a whole region I have neglected up until now. This is 20 at least orders of magnitude that I've glazed over. And the reason for that is that we as a community have not given this part of parameter space as much attention. Now, one might think part of the reason is that, well, there aren't any good dark matter candidates in this region, and there's really no point in creating an expensive experiment if you don't have anything to look for. Though I would disagree. I would say that there are actually a variety of different dark matter candidates in here which would be worth looking for. I'm going to call everything in this mass range blobs. I know blobs can have a specific meaning, but in this context, all of this dark matter, generically, I will call blobs. Dark matter are called stabilized black holes. Generally speaking, black holes in this part of parameter space don't make good dark matter candidates because they Hawking radiate, and they can survive the lifetime of the universe. However, black holes with masses in the 10 to the 17 to 10 to the 21 gram mass range are heavy enough that they don't Hawking radiate and are light enough that they evade at least a lot of different lensing constraints. So this is a parameter that's still roughly untouched. But there are other types of black holes which can get around Hawking radiation in other ways. One could have black holes which carry some sort of extremal charge, or black holes which are higher dimensional and don't Hawking radiate in the usual way because they have a different structure. I've also seen proposals for relics left over when black holes decay, so Planck mass relics, as being a potential dark matter candidate. The next general class is what I'm going to call nuclear dark matter. You might see this called nugget or sometimes blob dark matter. The basic idea here is dark matter which has strong self-interactions similar to what we see within the Standard Model, where small constituents can come together into dense nuclei-like clumps. Now, a lot of these models don't include long-range interactions, which would destabilize nuclei within the Standard Model. And so some of these models can create nuclei that are arbitrarily large or very heavy. And then finally, there are exotic compact objects. These are astrophysical sized objects, examples of boson star. These are sort of like astrophysical scale bosons and condensates, often made of ultralight dark matter, or dark fermion stars. You could think of these as being similar to a neutron star in that they form perhaps in the collapse of a cloud of fermions and are supported by degeneracy pressure. Now, this certainly isn't an exhaustive list of all the different dark matter candidates in this window, but it serves to show that there are a variety of things worth looking for in more detail. In truth, the problem is that dark matter in this mass range is very difficult to observe. A lot of the tools we normally rely on just aren't available. Blobs in this gap are really too heavy to be produced in colliders. Their number densities are quite low, and so it's not sensible to try to set up an Earth-based detector to look for them. And they're unfortunately too light for a lot of, or at least for the lensing effects that are available to us at the moment. Together, what this means is a lot of the tools we're used to aren't available, and we need to rely on how blobs interact with astrophysical objects or with themselves if we want to be able to see them. And this is where blob binary mergers come in and save the day. So if you're familiar with primordial black holes and binary mergers of primordial black holes, this will be very familiar to you. This is actually using the same analysis that's been applied to primordial black hole mergers. Particularly the universe, deep in radiation domination, blobs can form small gravitationally bound binaries. Now, over time, these blobs orbit each other and they'll lose energy through gravitational radiation. Eventually they merge. What's exciting about this is that this happens a lot. Blobs, and it's quite generic, blobs will form binaries, and those binaries are merging all throughout the history of the universe, but with a large number happening today. More blobs will collide by forming binaries than by random collisions in the Milky Way. This can produce observable either gravitational signals or electromagnetic ones, and this is a fairly model-independent effect. This is a gravitational effect. It doesn't particularly care about what the blobs are or many details of how they form or are held together. What's most exciting is that this applies to a really wide mass range of blobs, even beyond just the gap that I had showed you before. There's this whole...
I have a question. So what's the capture mechanism? So you say that they can be conformed as binaries. Is it just purely gravitational capture, like three-body interactions, or what? What do you have in mind?
Yeah, more or less. This is assuming, I mean, I'll explain it in a slide or two, but yeah, this is assuming that they are cold and more or less not moving quite early in the universe. And if they happen to be close to another blob, they would start falling into each other instead of moving apart with the Hubble flow.
Well, but they must release energy somehow, yes, so that they form a binary, a bound state. This is
assuming that they're cold. For a lot of these blobs, even if they have some thermal energy early in the universe when these binaries form, it's not really enough to prevent them from being able to fall into each other and form a binary. For some of the lightest blobs, it can be a problem. And in that case, they have to form cold and decoupled from the standard model bath.
No, I see what, I think my question is very simple. So if you just have, you know, two particles, even if they're at rest in the beginning, or two blobs, they will just, they won't form a bound state, right? They will just pass, next to each other, and that's it. So no, it must release some energy to form a binary.
No, that's not true, Sergey, right? You know, they can be form bound, right? You know, so the same way that
they can be form bound. That's good. Yeah, that's a good point.
Oh, well, right.
Right.
Like in the same way that dark matter halos are Born bound, right? You know, if the particles, the particles that fall into some future dark matter halo, they are born at high redshift, already gravitationally bound to each other. And so similarly,
right. I agree with you. Yes. So these binaries are what? Form bound.
Melissa, you're going to tell us.
In effect, I would say the same way the dark matter halos are, these binaries. Sorry. I think that'd be a good way of explaining it.
Melissa, but you're going to tell us about this in two slides from now, right?
Yeah, I will.
Okay, great. Right, good. Thank you.
Yeah. So these binaries, however they form, this does happen for a wide range of masses, pretty much any dark matter blob heavier than 10 to the 12 GeV can reasonably form binaries and merge at a high rate today. So I'll take you through the process now. So what we assume is that deep in radiation domination, and by that I mean redshifts of 10 to the 10 or to 10 to the 6, or temperatures of about an MeV down to maybe 100 EV, at these dark matter particles are cold. They're much more tightly packed than they are, and they are slowly moving apart with the Hubble flow. When I say cold, I assume they are effectively not moving, at least not with any particular velocities. The separations between them can be described by a Poisson distribution. If we happen to have two blobs, which are closer to each other than the separation, those may be able to decouple from the Hubble flow and begin falling toward each other. So we'll think about when these binaries form, basically based on when their gravitational attraction can overcome Hubble expansion, pulling them apart. Roughly, this translates to a redshift when their infall time becomes about equal to or less than a Hubble time, the time it would take the universe to expand by an order one factor. Now, this happens at earlier times for heavier blobs. They're more strongly attracted toward each other, and also happens earlier for blobs that happened to be closer together in the first place. Now, what this leads to is the beginning of a binary, which would have a semi-major axis, A, which describes as the orbit, proportion to how far apart the blobs are to start with, but also in proportion to the blobs, just because heavier decouple earlier or from the Hubble flow earlier, and so they are pulled apart by the Hubble flow less than the blobs are. Now, if two blobs...
What was X? I didn't...
So X, the co-moving separation between the blobs.
Oh, co-moving, okay. Okay, got it, thanks.
Yeah. And I guess, to avoid any confusion, why is the co-moving distance between the blobs, which will make our binary, and the next closest blob? Because if these blobs were alone in the universe, then they would just crash into each other. You wouldn't get a binary, you'd get a collision. But they're not alone. There are, in fact, lots of other blobs. And the ones in our binary are gravitationally attracted to all of these. So the other blobs will tidally torque the infalling binary and basically cause them to miss each other. This is what gives a highly eccentric binary and not a head-on collision. Now, eccentricity is another important parameter for this binary, and it measures how circular the one, and this can be estimated based on the starting position between the blob and the binary. So the nearest blob, that one that torques the whole thing most strongly. Now that we have a binary, over time, blobs are moving around each other and they will emit gravitational radiation. This will cause the binary to lose energy and eventually the blobs will crash into each other. How long this takes depends on the mass of the blobs. Heavier blobs can radiate more gravitational radiation, but it also depends on their initial separation. Bigger binaries have more distance to cover as they fall in, and so that takes longer. And it's also quite sensitive to the eccentricity of the binary. The higher the eccentricity, the more that orbit resembles a head-on collision, more or less, the more quickly the binary will lose energy. This is sort of an important feature because the majority of binaries merging in the present would have to be highly eccentric, as those just merge the most quickly. And then finally, our blobs collide. So we can estimate a merger rate based on an initial spatial distribution of blobs. From this, you can get a distribution of initial binary parameters, and from that, an estimate of a merger time distribution. Effectively, the merger rate comes from looking at what fraction of blobs have the correct distance between them, the next nearest blob, and the next nearest one after that, to form a binary. Now, for a sense of scale, the merger rate in the Milky Way halo today, for a 10 to the 15 gram blob, is about 90,000 events per second. This is assuming that F, the dark matter fraction, is 1. This scary fraction here is really just about -1. This goes as roughly mass to the -1. So this is a lot of events. This is a lot of events happening all over the Milky Way, and you know, this is for right now, but also all across time throughout the history of the universe. And I want to assure you, we've considered a couple of different complicating features and been generally conservative in getting this number. The first and probably most important complication is the fact that these binaries need to survive for about 14 billion years and merge in the present. And if they interact with other blobs, if they collide with another blob, then they can be disrupted. The main biggest problem is that when blobs make up and self-grad clusters during matter domination. And sorry, my thing just disappeared. Are you guys still there? Can you still hear me?
Yeah, we can hear you. Sometimes your audio breaks up, but it's fine. We can continue like that.
Yeah. Melissa, can I ask, can I ask you one thing? So the story that you just laid out is essentially the same story of formation of PBH binaries in the early universe. You formed them early.
Same story.
It's exactly the same, right?
Yes.
So then what distinguishes then your blobs from PBHs? Well, first of all, I guess they are lighter, so you need to produce them even earlier. That's one thing, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
And then the second thing is that somehow when you turn around and these things form, they don't form a horizon and they end up being blobs instead of PBHs?
I guess, are you asking how would the signal I eventually see look different from that of primordial black holes, or just how is this formation process different from primordial black holes?
Yeah, how is this formation process different from PBHs?
Oh, I would say generally it's not. There are a few things about blobs that make it more complicated because they are potentially larger physically than black holes are. And so we have to bear that in mind, but I'll talk about that in a moment. And because they're sometimes so light, they might be too energetic to form binaries when they're coupled to the standard model, when they're at the same temperature as the bath. But I'll also talk about that later. otherwise, I'd say the analyses for primordial black holes hold up for blobs. And that's essentially what I want to, you know, be telling you guys about today.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah, so, and again, this problem, which I'm describing here, does also apply to primordial black holes, but blobs will form these dense clusters. And if a binary falls into one of these clusters, it's almost guaranteed to be disrupted because there's a high scattering rate inside of them. And because, yeah, there's just lots of other blobs that are in close proximity to it for it to hit. So the number I gave you a moment ago, that 90,000, that is counting that the majority of blobs will fall into these clusters, and the majority that fall into these clusters are disrupted. The other complicating feature, which I didn't actually see who said it, but somebody sort of encouraged me to bring up just now, is that blobs are not black holes. They have a finite physical size. Generally, this means that they're collide a little bit earlier than what's predicted for primordial black holes. Most of the time, this isn't a problem. Only once the physical size of the blob becomes comparable to the size of the orbit do we see blobs colliding much earlier than expected. And that's when the merger rate predictions become start to break down. But just to give you a sense of what sort of blobs are and what aren't, down here I show what radii are allowed. So for a 10 to the 15 gram blob, which is merging today, can have a radius up to 10 to the 9 times its Schwarzschild radius before it gets too big to merge at the rate we would predict it would. And you can see this is this number up here. It's really like 1/4 or 1/5. So this is a fairly weak dependence on mass. So a wide range of blobs with fairly large radii can still form these binaries. And for scale, the sun has a radius which is about 10 to the 5 or 6 times its Schwarzschild radius. So again, these blobs can get quite large and still behave the way we want them to. And this brings me to observable signals. We know lots of blobs are merging all the time. And so then the question is, how do we actually look for it? Well, most generically, one can look for gravitational wave signals. Every single blob merger event is going to produce some sort of gravitational wave signal. Whether or not we can see that depends on the strain of the signal, which is its amplitude, H, and the frequency of the signal. Now, strain over here, again, that's describing the amplitude of your waves, is something that grows with the mass of the blobs and also the emission frequency. This DL here is the distance between us and the merger event, or the luminosity distance, rather, that are further away. Another important number is the ISCO frequency. So ISCO stands for innermost stable circular orbit. This is the orbit of the blobs right before they collide with each other. Generally speaking, it's when the strain and the frequency are the highest and we get the most signal. Now, for interest of actually looking for these signals in gravitational wave detectors, it helps to understand how they may differ from what's normally predicted for binary black holes. So for one thing, blobs have much lower masses than what would be expected for primordial black holes. As a result, the frequencies involved in their in-spiral phase are just generally higher than that expected for astrophysical black holes. These are also generally objects which have larger radii than black holes do. And this means they'll typically merge at an earlier time than predicted for black holes. And they'll be merging while emitting at a lower frequency than what would be expected for black holes of the same mass. And then finally, because these objects don't necessarily have event horizons, the ring down which is the period after the black holes merge, may look different, maybe less suppressed than it would be for a binary black hole merger. Now, to give you a sense of scale, here I'm showing a contour plot, which shows the, in pink, the different strains, and in gray lines, the different frequencies for the, I'd say, brightest point at the end of a merger, for the single closest merger event that one might expect after an average year of observation. Now, I'm doing this assuming that the blobs only make up 10 to the minus 2 of the dark matter. That's just because this is really where the interesting signals are gravitationally. But a lot of this parameter space is ruled out from being all of the dark matter. Along the bottom axis, mass in grams. Along the top is the mass in ounces. And then on the side, I've got the blob radius in terms of the Schwarzschild radius. Now, you might notice there's a lot of interesting features on this plot, so I'm going to walk through them. The first is just this gray region. I've blocked this out because this is where the blobs get physically too large, and their physical size suppresses the merger rate. Just more or less all of them are colliding earlier than expected. And related, you might notice that there's a knee in all of the contour lines. This is where the finite size of the blobs begins to suppress the merger rate and reduce the number that are available to collide today. Hasn't entirely destroyed it, but it is beginning to reduce it. You'll also notice this dip in some of the contours here. This comes from the transition between most of the merger events happening in the Milky Way to most merger events happening outside of the Milky Way. This is just because the abundance of mergers and the abundance of blobs is slowly decreasing as the mass goes up. And there just aren't enough that you would generically expect to see one merger event per year in the Milky Way, right around this dip. So what happens is the tip of...
Sorry, yeah. Lisa, can I stop you for a second? So I just two very short questions. So first of all, you said that F equals one is ruled out by what? I missed it. So
it's mostly gravitational lensing, but there are a variety of effects.
But these guys are very, very light. In solar masses, these things are tiny, no?
Yeah, I mean, gravitational lensing reaches down to 10 to the minus 21 grams. So you can see things more or less up to here with gravitational lensing.
From like this femto lensing thing is...
Oh, I'm not even including femto lensing. This is just micro lensing.
Oh, okay.
Okay. Wait, 10 to the minus 21, really?
Yeah,
oh no, 10 to the, just 10 to the 21 grams, which is 10 to the minus 12 solar masses.
Oh, okay. So it's 10 to the minus 12. Okay, yeah, I thought they were lighter. Okay.
Yeah, no, they're, I'll talk more about the lighter blobs when I get to the electromagnetic effects.
Okay, and the other thing that I wanted to ask you is that at least for PBHs, the story of the binary formation is a bit more complicated because there are two contributions. The one is the one that you talked about. Mm-hmm. And the other one is a contribution that people then figured out later, which is that after the halo forms, all the PBHs just go into the halo, and then within the halo, they form more binaries because now they are more dense and they find each other or something like that. And I don't remember exactly who are the authors, but this came out after the LIGO, the thingy where people were talking about PBHs for LIGO.
Yeah, there's actually another student at Hopkins who's been thinking about that. So my hope is to think about that next, because I think I could get, you know, an even stronger signal from looking at that effect. So yeah, I'd agree. That's like definitely another important effect to consider.
Okay, yeah, that's just not here. Okay, great, thank you.
Yeah, another time there is disruption that you mentioned already. So did you estimate it here for these masses or for other masses?
So I spoke to the people who did the simulations for primordial black holes, and their claim was that their simulations were more or less mass independent. So I was trusting that the effect that was originally done for roughly solar mass primordial black holes, the same clumping could also happen. It's just Poisson clumping, could also happen for lighter objects.
Well, these lighter objects are denser, yes. So there's more chance for disruption for them. I mean, there are more kind of objects passing by this binary, yeah, to disrupt it. So in this sense, there must be some. I mean, for very light objects, that should not work these simulations anymore. I would guess. Yeah, well, I wonder if you have a simple estimate for that, for the probability of disruption.
Unfortunately, I don't know that I can give you a simple estimate for the probability of the disruption. But I will say that with lighter objects, it's true, you do have higher number densities of them. And so these clusters can be more dense, mm-hmm. but all the interactions are also weaker mm-hmm. because they're, you know, lighter.
Mm-hmm.
And so I believe the impression I got is that part of the mass independence was that those effects kind of balance each other out.
I see. Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Like, but is it similar, you know, to what happens to, like, you know, stellar binaries and star clusters, right? You know, so like the binaries will get disrupted if they're if their orbital velocity, I guess, is small compared to like the velocity dispersion in the cluster, and they'll get more bound from the sort of scattering off of other stars, you know, if they are, if their own orbital velocity is fast, isn't that what happens? I can't recall exactly.
No. I know what you're talking about. Yeah. So that is very much true. And it is also the case that these binaries do get more tightly bound to each other. Like a fraction of them get pulled apart. A lot of them do get more tightly bound. The, I guess, weird feature is that even though they get more tightly bound, the scattering event tends to increase the angular momentum of the binary. And that tends to decrease the eccentricity. And because a lot of these lifetimes are so sensitive to the eccentricity of the binary, decreasing it a little bit can often increase the time it takes for the binary to merge by orders of magnitude.
Okay, yeah, that makes sense. Okay.
Yeah.
And so while you're stopped also, sorry, so for this plot, for your gray band, mm-hmm. you were saying that this is that region is where they all merge. Back in the very early universe and not today, is that what you were saying?
More or less, they all merge significantly earlier than expected, or the size of the blob is similar to, or the same as, or bigger than the distance between the blobs when they pass closest to each other in their initial orbit.
Right. Okay. So therefore, you're not considering second generation or third generation mergers.
Like from binaries that form later.
Some binary that merged together in your gray band back at redshift of a trillion.
Oh. You know,
that remnant might then merge with something else, and so on and so on.
Oh, interesting. No, I'm not considering that in this case. I imagine those might need a somewhat different formation mechanism if they do pick up, if they do start moving around a bit more as a result of the collision. I guess if the remnant left behind is cold, then, and the merger happens while we're still reasonably in radiation domination, then, yeah, I guess it would be possible to form other binaries. That's interesting.
Why would they not be cold after the merger? I mean, the merger is just moving at the center of mass velocity, you know?
Yeah, I guess as long as they're more or less the same mass, it's all right. I know that you can get kicks when you have binary in spiral with unequal mass objects. So I guess that'd be the only thing to worry about. But
yeah, those kicks happen from gravitational radiation, right? Like, you know, that doesn't happen here, is it? Oh, no, it is. You're right. Sorry. Well, okay. Well, right. Like, well,
I guess I actually know. You have a good point, because they're colliding early, so there's probably not a lot of gravitational radiation involved. So yeah, maybe that could also be a thing. I hadn't considered that.
Okay, all right. Thank you.
Yeah. Any other questions? Okay. Well, before we forget about it, yeah, this dip here is just that the mergers happening in the Milky Way are much closer to us than mergers happening outside of the Milky Way. And as a result, you know, we get stronger signals from mergers that are generally happening closer to us. There are a few more features I'm going to add to this plot. So one, this gray region, this is just ruled out by gravitational lensing at this fraction of the dark matter. So we can ignore that gray band. The other interesting region is this purple one and this light blue region. This shows the sensitive frequency bands for LIGO and MESA, the gravitational wave detectors. Just to give you a sense of what sorts of blobs would be radiating in the right frequency band. And then the last place of this plot that I think is interesting is this area I'm highlighting in yellow. Now, recently, there's been a lot of interest in developing high-frequency gravitational wave detectors. And to my understanding, this is mainly to look at gravitational wave signals from, say, inflation. Now, what's exciting is that blob binary mergers can produce gravitational wave signals at these high frequencies and at reasonably high strains. There aren't, to my knowledge, astrophysical sources that can do this. So this is both additional motivation for higher frequency gravitational wave detectors, and also a unique and distinct signal that one could look for. Now, it's possible that we can't actually resolve individual events, and that's okay. Because another option is to look for stochastic gravitational noise. This is almost a static noise signal that would come from all the different mergers happening all at once in the nearby universe. So in this plot here, again, I'm taking F to be 1/100th. Mass is in grams on the bottom, solar mass is up top, radius is in Schwarzschild radii. I've highlighted in red the parameter space where blob mergers would produce a stochastic gravitational noise signal that LISA would be able to see. This would be above the predicted noise and above LISA sensitivity. So this would be a new signal that one could actually look for once LISA's up and running. Unfortunately, we can't actually see the stochastic noise signal at LIGO. Now, if we're willing to be a bit more model dependent, we can also think about electromagnetic signals. So if blobs have some sort of coupling to the standard model, then they might produce some kind of electromagnetic something when they merge. Now, a lot of the time, what that signal looks like is going to depend on details of the blob, and it's going to depend on details of the energy of the electromagnetic radiation produced and of the specific particles that are produced. And so you can actually get even better constraints than what I'm about to show you if you have specific models in mind. But even without much of a model, we can still make some statements about blobs. So I'm interested in limiting what I'll call chi em. And this is the fraction of blob mass, which is transformed into electromagnetic particles after the collision, in the collision process. And there are two different fairly generic ways we can limit this or look for this. So one is through distortions to the cosmic microwave background. And the other is looking at excess gamma rays. So starting with the cosmic microwave background, blobs can produce angular anisotropy distortions because mergers were happening in the past just as much as in the present, even a little bit more in the past. So shortly after recombination, when electrons and nuclei have combined and made neutral hydrogen, and when the electron fraction in the universe is quite low, the universe is very sensitive to new injections of electromagnetic particles. Basically, any electromagnetic particles produced with energies above about 10 keV can scatter off of the neutral hydrogen, can excite the electrons, can produce new electrons, and overall will drive up the free electron fraction and produce observable distortions to the CMB. Because of this, there are pretty strict limits on how much electromagnetic radiation above this energy threshold can be produced shortly after recombination. And we can use that to place limits on how much of the blob's mass ends up coming out of these collisions as electromagnetic something. The other tool we have is gamma rays. Now, if I consider very high energy electromagnetic particles, by which I mean 36 TeV and up, any particles like this produced in blob mergers are not able to traverse cosmological distances. They just scatter off of the CMB, generating a gamma ray shower. The shower ultimately produces a gamma ray spectrum, which is independent of the starting spectrum of electromagnetic particles. It's just sensitive to how much energy was produced above this threshold. And this is quite useful because we can simply compare the gamma ray spectrum produced from all these merger events to what we actually observe. Say we shouldn't have more gamma rays than what we see. So for this, I relied on the Fermi Gamma Ray Telescope and its diffuse isotropic gamma ray observations. So putting this together, without really knowing anything about blobs, what they are, we can still make some statements about how much of blobs can become electromagnetic particles in collisions. And then for people who have specific models, something like that could be used to make a statement about their specific models. So here I've got mass in grams, and this is really spanning the light range of blobs. And then on the left axis, I've got chi em, which again, this is the fraction of blobs which are allowed to transform into electromagnetic something after collisions. And here, I'm assuming blobs are all of the dark matter. We really don't have to worry about constraints as much in this mass range. This is really the unconstrained sort of part of parameter space. So this turquoise region, this is ruled out because electromagnetic radiation produced in these mergers will distort the CMB. And this yellow region, which does keep going up behind the turquoise one, is ruled out by the electromagnetic radiation from mergers producing way too many gamma rays. But this is specific to very high energy radiation. You'll also notice that there's different regions I've highlighted in gray. And this has to do with the fact that at these low masses, blobs can be somewhat sensitive to the temperature of the thermal bath. So if blobs are coupled to the standard model background and at the same temperature of the background at some point, this can sometimes mean that they are too energetic when it's time for them to form binaries, and they might not actually be able to form binaries, or they might not form binaries as predicted when their time comes. So this unhighlighted region, this is where blobs are heavy enough that even if they thermalize with the standard model bath, they will still be able to form binaries as predicted. These are fine. This light gray region, this is where blobs could be in thermal contact with the standard model bath for some time, but they can't be in thermal contact indefinitely. When it's time for them to form binaries, they need to have decoupled from the bath and had some time to redshift away their excess kinetic energy. And then this darker gray region, this is where blobs can never be in thermal contact with the standard model bath. If they are, they will be too energetic and they will not be able to redshift away their excess kinetic energy fast enough to form binaries in time. So these blobs would need to form cold and remain reasonably decoupled from the thermal bath for them to behave in the way we predict they would. So I'm excited about this tool I'm describing, and I think this is really just the beginning. So there's a lot of work I'm excited about going forward. For one, I'm interested in making gravitational waveforms for these blob mergers so that we can actually look for them in gravitational wave data. There are some variety of blobs that should appear in the data. And I'm also interested in other mechanisms that can give me higher blob merger rates and therefore an even bigger signal than the one I described here. This could be disrupted blobs, which are disrupted binaries, where they were supposed to merge early, but then they scattered and now their lifetime is the age of the universe. This could be binaries that form in clusters. So there's a couple of options, which I think can give maybe a whole nother order of magnitude to the merger rate. I'd be interested in applying this to specific models and also considering blobs which interact through some sort of long-range charged force. Blobs like that will form binaries faster, they will merge faster, and so you can get stronger signals, but there are a few complications with that story that still need to be worked out. So this is all I have to tell you, so thank you all for listening to me today.
Thank you. Thanks, Melissa, for this very nice talk. Are there any more questions?
May I ask, what is the type of model that will generate like a gamma rays from these mergers?
So I guess you could imagine a sort of blob where it's let's say something similar, like a fermion star, something that looks maybe similar to a neutron star. In those mergers, if your blob could become a black hole or a low mass black hole, then you would certainly get gamma rays that result from the black hole remnant. I think that would be one of the easiest ways to get like high energy gamma rays. But I was thinking.
Sorry, what do you mean by like a black hole remnant? Like here.
Oh, so if two blobs collide and the resulting object is let's say no longer able to support itself through Fermi pressure and collapses, you could be left with a low mass black hole, one that is light enough that it decays quickly. And the Hawking radiation mostly is emitted, the Hawking radiation from that can become extremely energetic, especially as you get toward the end of that black hole's life.
Okay.
Yeah, so I would say, you mean specifically for like the high energy emission, yeah?
And also for the low energy emission, that would be my second half of the question.
There's plenty of ways to get electromagnetic radiation, even if you have a reasonably low interaction rate with the standard model. So these mergers are fairly violent. These objects, if they're dense, are hitting each other at relativistic velocities. And so, you have very hot merger events. And so if there's a weak coupling to the standard model, then you could potentially access that in the very hot, high energy conditions produced immediately in the merger. You might also have a scenario where some sort of burning process begins as a result of the merger. If the interaction rate between the constituents in these blobs is too fast, then you might get a fireball situation where the constituents in the blob are unable to escape because they're interacting too quickly. You've got many collisions, and then maybe some of them produce electromagnetic radiation, but that's the only thing that can escape because it's so much more weakly coupled to the blob constituents than the blob particles itself. So that would be like another sort of mechanism.
And you think like that can be like 10 to minus 3, 10 to minus 4 of the total energy density?
Yeah, so I was just thinking about this earlier, and I would say that something like a dark quark nugget, I've looked at those models, and it seems like with dark quark nuggets, there's some expectation that you might be able to get 1/100th of the kinetic energy from collisions to exit the collision as photons. And so these blobs-
As standard model photons.
Yes.
Interesting.
But one could also just look at, I guess not dark quark nuggets, but ordinary quark nuggets or axion quark nuggets, where the thing at the core is in fact standard model, just sort of in a peculiar state where it's normally difficult to access. In which case, a quark nugget collision could certainly easily produce large amounts of electromagnetic radiation.
Okay.
But, you know, that's, I think you can do much better with specific models. So, you know, these constraints just to show what you can do when we don't really know what we're working with. But if you do know what you're working with, if you have a specific model in mind, then I'm sure you can get even stronger bounds or find even more distinct observables.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Yeah, I want to come back to gravitational wave signal. Yeah, which, yeah, so actually there are two things which, I would like to understand better. So how model independent it is, and what masses are really accessible to it, even given, say, future experiments. Okay, there may be high frequency experiments looking for high frequency gravitational waves. Yeah, what masses can we really access? What are minimal masses we can access?
So in terms of like what we can see today, I would say, if I remember correctly, I believe LIGO is sensitive to maybe this area right here. That's the range where I would say right now, if we dug through the LIGO data, then these events would appear above background. In terms of LISA, I'm not actually sure. I would expect maybe a similar sensitivity range to what we get with LIGO. So really it's your heavier objects and the ones that are more dense. I'm showing this because I don't know what the capabilities are going to be in the future. I want sort of all the options available.
Right, but yeah, this is the case when it's like 1% of dark matter or something, right? I'm thinking, yeah, what if it is all of dark matter and I want to go to lighter mass ranges that you wanted before? I mean, lighter than I can probe with lensing. So is there any hope to get gravitational wave signal from these light objects measured in future? Shall we propose a new gravitational wave experiment which would be sensitive to high frequencies? Is there any kind of hope to measure that signal?
Well, you do have to be sensitive to extremely high frequencies to be able to do that. Because as we get to lower masses, you know, you're looking at a 10 to the 15 hertz signal. I have seen some proposals for gravitational wave detectors even at those high frequencies. I wouldn't expect you can go to much lighter masses or much higher frequencies than that, though.
I see. Mm-hmm. Thank you. Yeah.
So while you're here, I was just curious about like these like enormous sizes you're showing, where it's like millions or billions of times bigger than the Schwarzschild radius.
Mm-hmm.
So are these things big enough that they can evade these lensing constraints? Maybe, you know, like if those sizes are bigger than the Einstein radius, I guess to Andromeda. They would evade lensing, wouldn't they?
I guess if they are larger than their Einstein radius, you might be able to get around it. I don't know off the top of my head what the relevant Einstein radii are. I think those can be quite large potentially. I guess when I was wondering that myself, I worried somewhat that these objects might just literally block the light from signals, but they aren't really supposed to be electromagnetically interacting, so perhaps they wouldn't. Perhaps light would just pass through them.
Oh, that's true. Okay, that's true, right? All right, thank you.
Yeah.
I had one question. So you talked about the gravitational wave signal. You mostly talked about detecting the gravitational wave signal today, but presumably these mergers happen through the history of the universe and they keep emitting gravitational waves. Would that ever contribute to a large fraction of radiation energy density?
So the most energy that we could put into gravitational waves is more or less equal to the mass of the blobs. And so even if all the blobs merged all at once and all that gravitational energy was released, that would be basically the same energy density as the dark matter energy density. And I think at early times, that's small enough compared to radiation that that wouldn't make a difference.
Right, but if it happens near matter radiation equality, could be a problem.
Potentially, you would need a lot of them merging at once, and the fraction of blobs that are in a binary that's merging at any given time is fairly small. So I don't expect that that's going to be a problem.
Okay. Thanks.
Yeah, thank you.
Any other question? Otherwise, we can thank Melissa again. Thank you very much. And we can stop the recording.